talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Samantha Sazorka, a Nevada-based former Army journalist whose passion for horses, especially Mustangs, has spurred her to create the Nevada Discovery Ride. These are extended treks she takes with her adopted Mustang, Sage. The first was nearly 500 miles. The second covered more than 1,100 miles. These are partly to encourage wild horse adoption. Another of Sazorka's endeavors is serving as editor-in-chief of Sagebrush Rider magazine, a monthly publication presenting equestrian news, stories, and essays, chiefly from and about Nevada. We'll find out how far back her passion for horses extends, when her concerns for Mustangs began, her view of the related realm of the Bureau of Land Management, and all the complications and controversies that swirl around the agency's roundup of wild horses, as well as hearing about the Nevada Discovery Ride, the Sagebrush Rider magazine, and more, when I speak with Samantha Sazorka in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later in the show, I'll speak with Judy Bram, who, upon hearing that the Sarasota County Sheriff's Office canine officers, yes, the dogs, needed new bulletproof vests, launched a fundraising effort, and the dogs now have modern new vests. Right now, though, let's get to Samantha with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Samantha Sazorka on Talking Animals. Good morning, Samantha.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You bet. And how am I doing so far on the pronunciation?
Perfect.
Okay, great. I've been practicing all week, so let's hope I keep on track here. So clearly, obviously, a strong passion for horses permeates much of what you do, as I just sort of outlined. So let's trace that a bit. How far back does this go? Were you one of those little girls who loved horses?
I was. I was not fortunate enough to grow up riding, though. The passion sort of came to me a little later as a teenager when I was able to start riding, and I was stuck. And I will tell you, so as a teenager, and then I begged my mother to buy me a horse. I said, this is what I want to do. And she said, it's just a phase. All girls go through a horse phase. And I like a reminder of that still now, decades later.
Right. It's one of the more extended phases, I guess, on
record.
Absolutely. Yeah. Given that passion, and it has obviously extended over decades now, how did you squelch having that interest as the little girl and not really being able to, I guess, pursue it until you were a teenager?
Well, I wasn't, like I said, I didn't get to really do much. I dove in as a teen when I was able to, volunteered at any barn that would have me. I was happy just to clean stalls and be around horses. That was the dream as a teenager.
So that's how you at least started to act on the earlier fascination, if not love, for them.
Right. And then as I got older, I was able to continue and do a little more. I competed in college on our equestrian team and rode off and on throughout, my early adulthood as I was able to. And then really dove in, I would say, in the last 10 years or so once I left the military.
So really does sound like pretty much a lifelong storyline, with some parts of it, I guess, maybe more prominent or active, but it sounds like...
Yeah, and I didn't grow up in a horse family. I was the only one in my family that seemed to be horse crazy, and I don't know where that came from. I think you're just born with a gene or you're not.
No, that must have been interesting, though, because as that passion was becoming, I guess, probably more and more clear to your family, since there weren't other people who shared that passion, it must have seemed a little puzzling.
Oh, they didn't get it.
Yeah. Do they get it now?
Well, they're still not horse people, but they're incredibly supportive and excited and love what I'm doing. But I'm still the only one in my family. Anything with horses.
So I would have thought by now there might have been at least one recruit that you might have brought into the...
I guess I'm not doing a good job.
Well, I think in other ways, as we'll establish here shortly, that I think you probably are. It's just that I guess you haven't quite convinced the other family members. But yeah. So you alluded to... that it really kind of kicked up another notch after you got out of the Army. Let's talk a little bit about your service in your Army. First of all, when was that and how did that come about?
I served in the U.S. Army from 2004 to 2008.
Okay.
But I actually grew up around the Army. My father was in the military virtually my whole life. I grew up on Army bases and military schools. It was sort of very familiar and comforting to me to be in that community.
And I don't know if this is ever particularly a great term, but it sounds like something that often would be called a military brat then?
Army brat, yeah.
Yeah, Army brat,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So when I joined as an adult, it was just course. You know, it seemed very, very natural for me.
Right, so that's something that was almost expected, or whether it was your own expectation or a family expectation, that was just sort of normal, I guess.
Yeah, it wasn't odd.
Yeah. Wasn't as odd as liking horses, I guess.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
True. So I served from 04 to 08, and I was a public affairs journalist.
So what exactly does that mean? What were your specific duties, and who were you writing primarily for?
I basically traveled around and documented military operations for the military to then release to civilian media.
Okay.
So, for example, I spent a year in Iraq covering combat operations and humanitarian aid operations. Basically, everything Baghdad North was my area of operations, and so I just spent a year traveling around Iraq covering military things. And then the Army would take that video and make it available to CNN or MSNBC or NPR.
So this work was then, sounds like, mainly video-oriented as opposed to print, or was
Correct.
It? Okay.
I did video.
And did you enlist expressly with this sense of duty in mind, or did that evolve after you were already in?
I think it evolved for me after I was in. And initially, when I joined, it was really, again, because my father had served, and it just felt like kind of going home in a way to be around that community. And then once I was in and doing that job, the sort of full scope of it becomes clearer to you. So I also served a year in South Korea, and there I did radio and television for the Armed Forces Network.
Oh, wow. Was your dad at some point or another in his long military career involved at all on the media communication side?
No.
Okay.
That was not his job in the Army. And in fact, he passed away when I was a teenager.
Oh, geez. Sorry.
So suddenly and untimely. And so in a way, for me to join was sort of a way to honor him.
Okay. When you were in there over those 4 years, how did that experience match up with what you imagined, given that you did grow up with a father that was in the military? Pretty much that's what his career was.
You know, you don't understand the military until you're in it.
Yeah.
Or even if you grow up around it, it's different once you're in it.
Yeah.
So it was enlightening, frustrating at times, highly enjoyable at times. It was a strange combination. It was a wonderful experience overall.
Okay. Let me look, folks. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tune in, my guest is Samantha Sazorka, whose passion for horses has manifested itself in various ways, including creating the Nevada Discovery Ride, an extended trek she takes with her adopted Mustang Sage, partly to encourage wild horse adoption. We'll hear about that in a moment or two. If you'd like to ask Samantha a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Okay, so you served those 4 years, you get out. Now, how did you land in Nevada? Is that where you're originally from, or was there other circumstances?
No, when I left the Army, I was stationed in Fort Lewis, Washington.
Oh.
And when I was leaving, I knew I wanted to stay in the West. But I was open to anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would have pretty much gone anywhere. And so I just started sending my resume out to anywhere, any TV station that was hiring. And I said to myself, I will take the first job offer that I get, no matter where it is.
Wow.
And I received a job offer from a TV station in Reno, Nevada. I said, I'll take it. Now, where's Reno?
Well, yeah, you fulfilled your pledge, and I guess so it was first things first. Take the job and then find out where you're headed.
Exactly. It was kind of up for an adventure where the world wanted me to go, and I've been here ever since, though, so I think it was a good choice.
So what was the job, at least initially, there?
I spent several years as a television news producer, local affiliate.
Okay. And it sounds like that's not something you do now.
No. No, I've moved on to many other projects.
Well, some of which I guess we'll discuss, but are you, is any part of your day job still involved media or TV or video or any of those realms?
Well, now I'm on the other side. I'm doing public relations and marketing.
Ah, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, so I'm very interested in learning more about the Nevada Discovery Ride. I mean, how did the idea first come to you?
When I first moved to Nevada, I have to say, I don't think I even realized that wild horses were a thing that existed. I mean, I had never been in a place where I was exposed to them, and I just had never learned about them. And then I moved to Nevada. I started working at the television station, and Reno and Nevada in general is sort of ground zero for what's happening right now with wild horses. And so I dove in. I started covering these stories for the TV station, and I learned a lot very quickly about this very complicated issue in the West of wild horse management. And so it just, of course, being a horse person, it really stuck with me. I was shocked. I was fascinated. I wanted to know more, and I wanted to do more in a way. So that was all sort of happening in the background. And then I discovered this organization called the Long Riders Guild, which is an international association of equestrian explorers. And something about these stories of people traveling on horseback across continents, it just resonated with me. I was enthralled. These adventures that people were having in the modern era. And I thought, I didn't even know you could do that, Bill.
Yeah, seems like kind of a very much of a throwback.
Absolutely, but they are. You know, I was reading these stories of people riding across Australia or riding across Europe or Africa, and I just couldn't believe that people were doing it. And I thought, maybe I could do that too. So I kind of decided to start small with a 500-mile ride. That was my tester. So really, I just started thinking, okay, what could I do that's a long-distance journey? And I decided to ride across Nevada first. That was about 500 miles. And then it all sort of coalesced. It kind of was like this great way to promote wild horse adoption by riding my own formerly wild horse.
Just so we have a better sense compared to maybe what happens in the long riders overall, and on at least on your initial ride, the 500-mile ride, was it just you and that formerly wild horse, or were there other riders? Or
no, it was just us and our dog.
Yeah,
my dog Bella.
Okay,
joined us too. So it was me, the dog, and the horse. And I didn't know what I. Looking back now, of course. I learned a lot on the first ride. I didn't know what I was doing, but I made it. I started on the Utah border, and I rode straight across central Nevada to Reno.
Over what period of time?
I spent a month, so camping, tent camping every night and riding every day.
Back to the long riders thing, which you had discovered and then sort of, it seems like, influenced this. Do those kind of rides typically involve multiple riders, or are they often solitary as well?
No, most long riders tend to ride solo.
Okay.
Maybe a small, you know, two. But for the most part, it's solo riders. I think there's, I'm not sure why. I think there's just something for a lot of long riders, it's a very personal journey.
Yeah, so it sounds like that's kind of part of the point of the experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. So you do the first one. It's the better part of 500 miles. It works. You get through it. What were some of the either adventures or misadventures that happened over the course of those 500 miles?
Oh, the first ride was, you know, every day was a challenge. Like I said, I don't think I knew as much as I thought I did at the time. And so I learned a lot on the trail about what worked and didn't work and what gear was good and what gear I should not have brought or how I should have maybe routed a little differently.
Okay.
Nevada's a tough country. You know, outside of Reno in Las Vegas, it's the high desert, and it's open space. So there's no, you know, I rode pretty backcountry the whole way.
Okay.
A lot of mountain ranges to cross. It's the wild. So I learned a lot about, you know, the food I should have brought.
Okay.
We had some adventures along the way, but we made it, and I was so excited when I was done that I immediately said I want to do this again, even more. And that's when as soon as I got home, I started planning my next ride.
Well, and was part of, like, the sort of excitement and the buzz of, like, hey, yeah, there were some tough times and I learned some things, but I really want to do this again. Was part of that saying, not only do I want to do it again, but I really want to kind of go for double the journey?
Yeah, because I think what got me was I felt this sort of adrenaline rush of having gotten through challenges, real challenges. We don't often push ourselves outside of our comfort zone in our life. You know, we like things to be comfortable, and I was certainly not comfortable living on the trail. And I thought, I can't believe I did that. I was so proud of myself. I felt almost invincible. Well, I could do this again and go for even longer and do it better this time because I've learned so much.
Right. Well, so apart from recognizing that, okay, I would bring some different food or not bring some of the food I brought, and that the terrain itself was rough and challenging, what was kind of one or two of the biggest other challenges or things that you learned that you then took into planning the second ride?
I would say, well, that's a great question. Because in large part, the second ride was a lot like the first ride, just even longer.
Better and longer, I guess.
But we had a lot of the same challenges, and those are challenges that you can't get around. So, for example, you know, the extremes in weather, whether it's the summer heat and torrential rain and snow even a little bit.
Mm.
You know, there's nothing you can do about weather. The terrain, you can't do anything about either. We had some pretty extreme elevation gains. You know, on this last ride, we rode up and over 26 mountain ranges. You can't, that's part of the fun, though. Ironically, one of the bigger challenges was wildlife. And then people are often surprised to hear that it was wild horses that were our constant battle with wild horses.
Oh, how so? Because, I mean, obviously, one of the things I hope we'll get into at some point in the next few minutes is wild horses. I mean, we've alluded to it, and you've said the horse that you ride is a former wild horse, and that mm-hmm. part of the reason you do it is to sort of call attention to and encourage people to adopt. Yeah. So, but, I mean, it is a complicated thing, and you touched a little bit on, I mean, I definitely want to get into just the whole Bureau of Land Management, and just seems like there's all kinds of issues and controversies and things that surround that world.
But in terms of on the trail, it all sort of, you're in it. So there's maybe 80,000 wild horses and burros in the U.S. Most of them are in Nevada. Nevada has more wild horses and burros than any other state. And I think we saw them all on our
okay.
ride.
Okay, yeah. And did they, as they saw you coming, is that what posed some of the challenges? Is that A, there's a lot of them, and B, they are wild, and so there you are just riding along with Sage. And what's the dog's name again?
Bella.
What is it?
Bella.
Okay. Oh, Bella. Okay. And so were there some kind of odd or even uncomfortable moments with a horse and horse encounter or a horse and dog encounter?
Mostly horse and horse. Wild horses they can be extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
They're, of course, large animals.
Yeah.
But they are very territorial animals, and they know from even miles away when a strange horse is moving through their territory.
Yeah, and they don't like it.
No, and they definitely want to defend it. And
okay.
So it was a regular occurrence on the trail to be charged by wild stallions, and sometimes groups of stallions, sometimes whole bands. We were charged on one point on this last ride by about 50 horses, and then I stopped counting, of course, to try to get them away. So on the trail, sometimes in the middle of the night in camp, I'd be awoken at 2 o'clock in the morning, and by the sound of thundering hooves in the dark, and I'd have to jump out of my tent and chase horses out of camp. So they were kind of constantly trying to get to my horse.
And how often in some of those encounters did you feel in danger?
Often.
Okay.
Honestly,
yeah. Yeah, you seem very casual about it. Yet, as you're kind of describing it more, I'm thinking, geez, middle of the night, horses galloping. I'm thinking, wow. I mean, not to mention just down in the midst of a ride where, you know, horses are defending their territory. It just
right.
seems
well,
like.
potentially very dangerous. And if the horses had been able to get to my horse, I mean, that's what you do not want to happen. You don't want your horses fighting with wild horses. So I think in terms of feeling in danger, it was more this idea of I needed to protect my horse, not necessarily myself. I wasn't worried about me, but my horse.
Yeah.
That I had to defend regularly.
Right. Although if you were on the horse at the time and the other horses are saying, hey, get the heck off my territory here, it just seems like you're at risk at that point on some.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, let's take, we had a caller that's been holding. We got an email or two I want to get to. So, hi, you're on Talking Animals. Samantha Sazorka.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing your Wild West adventures. A couple of things. First of all, you know, horses used to be native to this continent before a couple of mass extinctions, and they were brought here to be reintroduced in a domesticated form by the early conquistadors. So they're much more native now, in a sense, than cattle. And what drives the BLM's war, and it is a war, against wild horses are the cattle ranchers who, for profit, are destroying far more native western lands than wild horses ever could. And so I'd like you to talk about that. One other thing is this. You know, horses didn't ask to be ridden, trained, or broken. They were taken from their wild state and made into beasts of burden. The movie War Horse is a perfect illustration of that. So I wonder if you've ever considered the ethics, number one, of, you know, using another animal to ride on when it can't voluntarily consent. Number two, of going across the terrain and with your dog and your horse invading these animals' territory. Is that ethical?
Okay. Well, thank you for your call and those questions. And Samantha, you can field them in whatever order you'd like to respond.
Sure. Thank you. Those are great questions. I guess to your first point about cattle and horses being a reintroduced species, I will say right off the bat, I'm not a rangeland scientist. That is not my area of expertise. So I can't speak on behalf of the Bureau of Land Management or their policies. For me, this project was always about promoting adoption, not delving into some of the behind-the-scenes logistical policy issues. That is very complicated. There are good people on both sides. But for me, I thought what I can do is show people what wild horses could do. So one of the biggest issues is that once the horses are removed from the range, periodically they're rounded up or gathered by the Bureau of Land Management, those horses can never be returned to the range. They will never be returned to the range. So their only option is to live out the rest of their life in a holding facility or be adopted. And over the last few decades, adoption rates have plummeted. They were at relatively historic lows, actually, within the last few years. Just fewer and fewer people adopting wild horses.
And is there, sorry to interrupt, Samantha, but I'm just curious, what accounts for those adoption rates plummeting?
I think we can say the economy, for one. Two, are the nation's sort of use of horses has changed dramatically. Fewer and fewer people have horses, period. Number two, there's not a lot of money to promote adoptions outside of the West. So here in Reno, where I live, everybody I know has a Mustang, has a wild horse. We've all adopted. But if you travel back east, there are people who didn't even know that wild horses existed.
Yeah.
So it has to do with money and the lack thereof to promote adoptions and facilitate them, and then just the economy in general. So again, for me, this ride was a way let me take my horse. We'll do this grand adventure and show people how trainable and reliable a Mustang can be, and then hopefully encourage other people to adopt. And I'm happy to say we have done that through the ride.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not sure how often you've gotten the kind of question that our caller posed, but I had a similar question of mine, and then one of our emailers has asked sort of a related question, you know, some of which speaks to just the idea of just even on a philosophical level, people who have questions or opposition to horseback riding, just because, as our caller said, the horse can't consent, which of course is true, although with this show and the name, I'm always looking for a talking animal of some kind, so maybe they could at some point respond. And just the way that I think in some cases people perceive the way that horses are treated in those settings, or in just circumstances where they are ridden. So is that kind of question or issue come up in the course of talking about the rides that you have taken?
It has.
Yeah.
It's not the first time.
Sure.
Has brought up the question of the ethics of horseback riding.
Right.
And surprisingly, just the other night, my husband and I were talking about it, this very question.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, horses have an incredible history with humans, not just in America, of course, but throughout human history. Our history is sort of intrinsically tied to horses. Our mm-hmm. development as people in some way is tied to our relationship with horses. That is to say that, not to say that there are not people out there who have taken advantage of that. Perhaps, and some horse industries are problematic. They're in their, let's just say, cruelty. I can think of nothing better for a horse than to do what we did, which was to just travel at a slow pace.
Yeah.
The most natural thing for a horse. In the wild, horses typically travel up to 20, 30 miles a day on their own. They sort of meander about that distance every day. So it's very natural for a horse to move. What is not natural is for them to be stalled in a 10 by 10 or 20 by 20 corral for their every day, for their whole life. I thought it was a wonderful thing to do. My horse, again, formerly wild, he was born on the range in Nevada. He was gathered when he was about 2. But for 2 years, he was free and roaming. That was his life. So for me, doing this journey with him, again, we're not endurance riders. We're not racing. We're not trying to do anything, you know, that crazy. We're just grappling. In
yeah.
the place that he was born and the place that he grew up, at a walk. We walked every day. To me, that is not cruel. That I think is actually the kindest thing to do for him, to be back out in the place where he would like to be. Since he cannot be wild anymore, this is the next best thing.
Right. It sounds like the way, for better or worse, there are in many realms of animal welfare kinds of things, that there's sort of a continuum here. And if I understand your explanation of at least what happens with wild horses there, is that if they are rounded up, then they're going to end up in a holding facility. And I don't know how long that lasts versus a darker fate, which we can also talk about, I guess, briefly. So either they stay in that holding facility, or they're sold off to wittingly or unwittingly a slaughterhouse, or they're adopted. And I guess those are pretty much the three main scenarios, right?
Correct. Although the Bureau of Land Management, the wild horses are federally protected from slaughter. So the Bureau of Land Management cannot directly sell them to slaughter. So really, the options are holding facilities for the rest of their life or adoption.
Yeah.
I wish that I was able to have hundreds of acres where my horse could roam, but I do not have that. This is the next best thing to come out. And if I could touch on the caller's last question.
Sure,
about,
please.
The ethics of, I think he said, invading wild horses' homes. You know, I think our footprint was very small, traveling with one horse and a dog and one human. We very small footprint, a tent, you know, food and rations and a horse. I never felt like we were invading. In fact, at all possible points, I tried to avoid wild horses, particularly for the reasons I mentioned earlier of the inherent dangers.
Sure.
But the vast majority of Nevada is public land. 80-some percent, 86% or so of Nevada is federally managed public land, which means it is open and free to use for people to roam. And I think what better way to use public land than to travel on horseback.
And so maybe this is a good time to maybe elaborate a little bit more on sort of what does go on relative to that 80% of public land with the Bureau of Land Management. And then, as our caller alluded to as well, there are cattle ranchers and others that sometimes put those factions in conflict. And, I mean, how does that work? And we've also gotten another email or two about the BLM roundups and how those, at least in terms of being captured on video, can look quite brutal. So maybe you could address whatever aspects of the land, the 80% public land versus what happens with the cattle ranchers and or just the BLM roundup.
It's not just cattle ranchers.
Okay.
People forget that public land is not just BLM land, it's Forest Service land, it's Fish and Wildlife land, it's state parks. There's a lot of different agencies managing public land. So, yes, the BLM does manage the lion's share. They're in a hard place. They have a multiple-use mission. Public land means it's public to everyone. So they have this sort of impossible position where they need to balance the needs of multiple users to include recreational users like horseback riders and hikers.
Mm-hmm.
That also includes ranchers who have grazing rights, who graze their cattle on public land. That also includes mining companies who use public land. It also includes the military, who uses quite a bit of public land in Nevada. So you have all these different interests that have an equal right to the use of public land. And so it's not surprising that those interests clash and have done so for a long time, but particularly in recent history, it's sort of gotten to a bubbling point, I think. And then to your second question about roundups, it's contentious. Here's what happens. The Bureau of Land Management looks at each area of the state and other states, and they say this area can support X amount of horses, and they base that on range conditions, other use of the land that's needed, water conditions, a lot of environmental impact, and they say, well, this area can sustain, let's say, 100 horses. If they come and they count and they see there's now 200 horses, they will remove 100 because they're always trying to keep it to that level that they have set.
And when you say...
go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say quickly, sorry. So when you say, like in that example, they remove that 100, does that mean that 100 gets relocated or that 100 goes to the holding facility?
Holding facilities.
Okay, so anytime they're rounded up, they go to the holding facility. There's no effort to sort of...
If they're able, they will re-release, certain stallions or certain family bands. It just depends on the area.
Yeah.
But in general, no. Once they're removed, they're permanently removed because they're always trying to keep that population level to the level that they have set. Now, there have been efforts in recent years to introduce fertility control to help on the range keep that population level at a sustainable level, but that is still early in the process and hasn't been adopted everywhere. But those roundups they don't look great. You've got hundreds of horses being run across the land. You got helicopters, maybe some cowboys on horseback helping out. It doesn't look great. I don't know how you make that look good.
There probably is no way to make it look good because it's rough, it looks like. And it's so here's a question, and we're sort of running out of time, and I still want to get to your magazine at least briefly. But when the horses do end up in a holding facility, is there a term, a timetable, or are they there indefinitely, or how does that work?
Well, if they're not adopted, they're there the rest of their life.
Okay.
So they typically start at a short-term holding facility. Maybe they go to some adoption events. And if they're not, then they are moved to a long-term meaning the rest of their life. Now, there are some wonderful programs, though, that have come up over the last few years to help facilitate adoption. My horse came from a prison program here in Nevada. So after he was captured, he was sent to prison, a literal prison, where he was paired with an inmate for 90 days, and the inmate worked with him to gentle him and train him, to at least start the training.
Okay.
And then I adopted him from the prison. And what a wonderful program for the inmate, for the horses. Everybody sort of benefits from something like that. It'd be wonderful to see that replicated on a larger scale to help other people adopt.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're in our final moment or two. We're going to try to get one more call, and then I am going to ask you about your magazine. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Samantha Cizorka. Hello, it's you.
Hi. I just had a question or a comment.
Okay, please, go ahead.
I know that Samantha mentioned, environmental resources, water, things like that, and all of that needing to be considered by the BLM and such. And I guess I would wonder why cattle and non-native species who, it takes a tremendous amount of water to raise and to produce the products that come from them, how we can square removing these horses when, there's a terrible drought. Obviously, in California, there's lots of cows. There's 9 billion cows on the planet. And I guess it just seems strange to me that the wild horses are having to be rounded up and held in facilities for their life. I don't know what these facilities are like, but I'm sure they're nothing like the wild. For the sake of that, there's also a lot of development, and we talk about the horses being overpopulated and only 100 for this area. You know, there's a whole lot of development for humans, and you know, and like I said, all the cows which are being raised in the high desert, which is such a silly thing, it seems. So I just meant that that really seems at odds and unfair to the horses and to other wildlife who are affected by such a wasteful industry.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you for your question. We'll get Samantha to respond briefly, if you could, Samantha, only because I do want to...
I'd just say, you know, it's not at odds for cattle to be in Nevada. Nevada's got a long history of sheep and cattle ranching, actually, on the range. A really long history of that in the high desert. But to her larger point, to be perfectly blunt, in my opinion... The issue is that cows are profitable, horses are not. I mean, you're looking at a you know, multi-million-dollar industry. Cattle make money, horses do not. So to me, the ugly truth.
Yeah, well, amazing how often things do reduce down to the almighty dollar, for better or worse. Yeah. So let me just quickly say, because I keep promising, and now we're almost desperately out of time, but I do love the idea of you presiding over a horse magazine, partly because I like the idea of anyone presiding over a magazine these days, and I can only assume this is like a passion project. So what, I guess this is, even though this is print, and it seems like at least partly an outgrowth of your journalism background and obviously your huge passion for horses, what's the best part of working on the magazine?
It really does combine all the things that I love. What I wanted to do was to tell stories. I wanted to share these stories from Nevada's equestrian communities because, again, Nevada is a very large state and it's very spread out. Our communities are spread out. So what people in Reno don't always know is happening down in Pahrump or Las Vegas or Elko, for example. So the project, starting the magazine, was a way of, it was very selfish. I wanted to go meet people, hear their stories, and then share them with others.
And so it's a monthly magazine. And is it a hard magazine as well as online?
We only publish online.
Okay. It looked like, when I saw it, I thought so, but some of the design and photography and other stuff made me think, wow, I wonder if this actually exists beyond online.
No, just online for okay. now. We just okay. launched in March, so we've had 5 issues so far, and the response has been great. People are interested in knowing what's happening in Nevada with horses. My readers are not just in Nevada. I've got subscribers from all the surrounding states and even beyond. It's really fascinating to see.
All right. Well, that's, again, I just find it fascinating in this media landscape that that's what you're doing, and my hat's off. So I just want to be sure to at least mention that. And that and all the other kind of things that we've touched on can be found on the website NevadaDiscoveryRide.com. So again, we've been speaking with Samantha Sazorka. And Samantha, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Great. Thanks. In a few moments, I'll speak with Judy Bram about her efforts to help raise the funds to provide the canine officers in the Sarasota County Sheriff's Office canine ballistic vest, what many of us might call bulletproof vest. Right now, though, let's step into the Comedy Corner. Thought we should do something horse-related, of course. And I've got Seinfeld on my mind, given the new batch of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee shows released recently on Netflix. So let's hear part of a longer piece called Horses in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animal.
When you're on the road, which I am not now, you have to do whatever anybody suggests to do for that day, because you got to do something. A couple weeks ago, we were in Pittsburgh. We went to the track. Bet on the horses. This is idiotic. I think it's fun, but I never would think for a second that I could figure out what horse is going to win. I don't even think the horses know that they're racing. Do they? I mean, are they walking back to the stable afterwards going, I was third, I was fifth, I was ninth. You cut me off, watch that. I'll kick your ass next time. I think more likely they're thinking, oh, bag, I get my oat bag now. Oat bag time for me. I mean, I'm sure the horses have some idea that the jockey is in a hurry. I mean, he's on him, he's urging him, he's hitting him, come on, come on, you know. So this is important that I get somewhere for this guy quick, but they must get to the end and go, We were just here. What was the point of that? This is where we were. That was the longest possible route you could take to get where you wanted to be. Why don't we just stay here? We would have been first. I'll tell you one thing the horses definitely do not know. They do not know if you should accidentally trip and break your leg at any point during the race, we're going to blow your brains out. I think they're missing that little tidbit of information. If they knew that, you'd see some mighty careful stepping coming down that home stretch. Easy, fellas, easy. You win, I'll place, whatever it is. All the same oat bag, fellas. The important thing is your health.
That's right. The important thing is your health. That was Jerry Seinfeld with the initial portion of a piece called Horses, taken from his CD, I'm Telling You, for the last time. Now, let's speak with Judy Bram about those bulletproof vests for the canine officers who protect and serve in the Sarasota County Sheriff's Office. This is Judy Bram on Talking Animals. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Let's start out by hearing about your relationship with the Sarasota County Sheriff's Office. How did this all come about?
Well, I followed the Sarasota County Sheriff's Office Facebook page. My husband is a retired officer, and I also have a page that I admin here in Sarasota County. And so I'd like to share any stories from the Sarasota County Sheriff's page that promote officers in a good light.
Okay.
And I saw that they had posted a picture of one of their canines, Ondo, and he was wearing a ballistic vest, and they had made a comment, if only they could get five more. So I commented, and very naively, I asked, well, how much is a vest? Because I'm thinking they're only a couple of $100, and my husband and I, you know, we would purchase a vest for them.
Sure.
And they came back, and they said that they were $1,700, which was very surprising.
Wow, these are fancy vests, apparently. Yeah.
Yes, they are. So I was already working with their community outreach person, Caitlin Perez, on another project. And so I said, I think my comment back was something like, well, you know, maybe we could, I'll get in touch with somebody and maybe we could do some kind of a fundraiser. And she immediately reached out to me and said that that would be great if I wanted to do a GoFundMe. And I'm, you know, more than happy to help. And but I kind of was in the back of my mind wondering what I was committing to, because I'm thinking, oh, gosh, we're going to have to raise enough money for five vests. That's like $8,500. I'm thinking we're going to have to do a GoFundMe. We're going to have to do cookie sales. We're going to have to do, you know, barbecues. But she was really confident that the GoFundMe would be all that they would need, and she was right. It was fantastic. We raised the money in 4 days.
Wow, isn't that incredible? I mean, crowdfunding is remarkable in so many ways, and certain things just seem to click or strike a chord, and people just jump in, and it sounds like, as in this case, your expectations are quickly exceeded.
Yes. Well, I think that it's you know, it struck a chord with two different types of people. There's those that are very pro-law enforcement still, thankfully.
Yeah.
And then there were those that love animals and dogs specifically. So we had that. And there were a couple of individuals that saw the post. One was a group called Non-Knights Motorcycle Club. They're made up of law enforcement officers and veterans. And they saw the post, and they right away purchased one vest outright from their motorcycle club. And then a couple of private donors saw the GoFundMe, and they reached out to me, and they each purchased a vest outright. So that reduced the amount needed.
Sure.
But then private, or you know, the community at large, we had people making $20 donations, $25, $50, $100. We had people just give $5, and so then we were able to raise the remaining, I think it was $4,100 that we raised. But altogether, $8,500 was raised to get the five vests that were needed.
Yeah, and I'm sorry if you did mention this and I missed it, but when you guys were planning the GoFundMe, was there an initial estimate of how long you figured it would take to hit $8,500?
Not really. I mean, Caitlin thought that it would go quick. I mean, she did, because I said something about, oh, we'll probably have to do barbecue. She's like, no, you'll be surprised. Quickly, because we have a lot of people that really love the dog. And It's kind of funny because I'm really not a big dog person. I have a dog and she's treated well, but I'm a cat person.
I see. Well, cat vets must be next. But now we just have a moment or two, really sort of almost out of time here, Judy. But I'd just be curious, do you happen to know, all kidding aside, what some of the key features are of these new vests? Because again, as you said, you were kind of surprised, as you and your husband were, when you thought, well, we'll pitch in a couple hundred bucks. That'll get us a vest. And it was $1,700 instead. What are some of the elements of this vest that make it so? Obviously, it gives great protection to the animal, but is there any other features that come to mind?
Well, I'm really not a firearms person, but I remember that the officer mentioning all the different types of bullets that the vest can take.
Oh, wow.
And so that they can take all different types of bullets, and they also mentioned that they were slash-proof and puncture-proof, so if someone does try to stab the animal, unfortunately, the vest will prevent that. They're very lightweight. The previous vests were 10 pounds. These are only 4 pounds. So before the dog, they used to only be able to put the vest on when it was needed. And that wasted some time, of course. Now the dog can wear the vest all day long and be comfortable.
That's great. Well, Judy, we are out of time, but I just wanted to have you tell your story. I think it's just so great and it's amazing, of course, that it went so fast. And now these dogs got state-of-the-art protection, it sounds like.
Yes, they do, and they deserve it. They're heroes.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks so much for that help on their behalf, and thanks for joining us today on Talking Animal.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. All right, coming up at 11 is Rob Lori and Radioactivity, kicking off a 3-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Ellett in the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Next week, I'm talking to my guest, will be Barbara Trask Lovett, the president of Save Nosy Now. I'll tell you all about that next week. It's time for NPR News headlines.